This week, we'll look at the latest corruption scandal rocking South Africa's presidency. How did Cyril Ramaphosa, who came into office promising good governance and vowing to crack down on corruption, get tangled up in a corruption scandal of his own? We'll have an in-depth discussion of the inner workings of Africa's oldest liberation movement, the African National Congress. Also, Karine Kaneza Nantuya from Human Rights Watch talks to me about the state of human rights across the African continent and why she says the work of Africa's Rights Commission is more important than ever. Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome. I'm Heidi Adams. It's so great to be with you. Cyril Ramaphosa is not the first South African president or leader of the African National Congress Party to be dogged by allegations of corruption. While graft claims do not surprise most South Africans, analysts say it's taking a toll on the ANC's popularity. Zahir Kasim reports for us from Johannesburg.
Nelson Mandela's African National Congress may have brought freedom to South Africa, but that freedom has been marred by corruption allegations at the party's highest levels. The ANC faces a crisis after a report by an independent panel found President Cyril Ramaphosa may have broken the law and violated his oath of office. The panel's report says large amounts of foreign currency were stolen at Ramaphosa's private game farm in 2020 and that he failed to report that the money was missing. Ramaphosa has denied wrongdoing and he has not been charged with any crimes. On the streets of Johannesburg, South Africans react to the party's latest crisis.
I'm always disappointed by the ANC. I don't have any faith in them. They don't do much for us. They do much for themselves and their families.
I mean, I was very hopeful when there was the original change, when the ANC came to power. And it's just been a systematic disappointment over the decades of ANC power and leadership.
It's high time that we really need a change. We need to see all the social responsibility being delivered to the people.
Despite the frustration of another scandal, experts say the ANC faces tough choices regarding Ramaphosa's future with the party.
All the surveys that I'm aware of indicates that if Mr. Ramaphosa leaves the ANC, the level of support drops by anything between 5 and 10%, maybe even a bit more, which leaves the party at somewhere between 35 and 45% national support. So that means they no longer have the majority to govern if we go to an election now.
Analysts say that the party has seen declining support with every election due to its failure to provide basic services like clean water and electricity to the public. Former President Jacob Zuma's tenure was clouded by corruption allegations as the nation's infrastructure declined. An inquiry into state graft also found that under Zuma's watch, state anti-corruption units had been dismantled and law enforcement weakened. Ramaphosa campaigned on fighting graft, and though it has been a long journey, one civil society watchdog, Corruption Watch, says Ramaphosa has made improvements.
Prior to President Ramaphosa's appointment, prior to his election into office, civil society wasn't allowed a seat at the table. We were often shunned, distrusted. There was no real working relationship, whereas now I think there's quite a solidified relationship because the ANC government under Ramaphosa has taken an approach to say that fighting corruption is a whole of society initiative. It can't just be up to government or up to law enforcement. So they're involving everybody.
Ramaphosa says he will challenge the disciplinary report. Political analysts say he is a strong contender to remain the party's president at the upcoming ANC conference due to begin December 16th. Zahir Kasim for VOA News, Johannesburg.
So how did South Africa's president, who came into office promising good governance and vowing to crack down on corruption, get tangled up in a corruption scandal of his own? Well, here to discuss this with me, I'm joined in studio by Chamano Makadi. He's a broadcast lecturer at Tshwane University of Technology in South Africa. And also with us is Piwokushle Mnyandu. He's a professor of African studies at Howard University here in Washington. And of course, no stranger to the show. Gentlemen, what a pleasure it is to to have a whole South African panel here to discuss with the South African politics. Welcome. Thank you so much. Pibo Kushli, I'm going to start with you. Can you briefly just give us sort of the top lines of how Cyril Ramaphosa got into this situation in the first place?
Well, it's quite a difficult job to do because it's been a haze of activity. Well, the genesis would be June this year. A man called Mr. Frazier, who was an ex-head of SSA. SSA is basically a mixture between the CIA, Homeland Security type for South Africa, so intelligence in South Africa. He walked into a police station and laid charges against the president of South Africa. These charges included money laundering, defeating the ends of justice, and kidnapping, basically amounting to that at some point in 2020, unbeknownst to South Africans, there was a theft that took place in a farm of the president. And this was a theft, of course, which is why we're here, a theft of lots of dollars, lots of money. So he's in trouble because you're not supposed to have many that amount of money in South Africa in foreign currency. He didn't report this. And also the allegations that instead of reporting this to the police, he basically turned to the head of his presidential guard, which would be akin to an American president turning to the head of the Secret Service and saying, someone stole something from me, go and find out. So these people were pursued all the way to Namibia. We're not clear on the facts, but it is alleged that they were taken back, interrogated, and we don't know whether it was at Mr. Ramaphosa's behest, but by agents acting on behalf, on action pursuant to this theft. So that's why we are here. Parliament says they want to investigate, and they basically activated Section 89, saying, well, which is the section that we can impeach a president if they break the law or there is misconduct. And they had an independence panel, and this panel came back saying there's grounds or there are questions that Mr. Ramaphosa must answer, and that's why we're here.
Chamano, I want to get your take. You work in this realm of media, a reporter covering South African politics for a long time yourself. If we look at some of the media coverage, it makes it seem like this is a political crisis for South Africa. Is it a political crisis for the whole country, or is it really a political crisis for Cyril Ramaphosa?
Well, I think there's a fine distinction. Surely, it will be a crisis for the country in a sense that there will be some kind of instability. For example, I mean, if a country is going for days, perhaps maybe without a president, and by that I mean a person who is actively involved in the affairs of the country. Obviously, that then becomes a crisis because a number of things that are going to be affected. Surely, it is going to be the business of the country, the day to day
running of the
country. So that then becomes a crisis within that context. But obviously, for Cyril Ramaphosa himself, it is a big headache for something like this to happen, days or weeks leading to a very important conference for him. Obviously, as we know, he is contesting for the position of president for the ANC, and should he, get to be elected, to a certain extent, we can say, well, is there a chance to become a president for the country when we go into elections, depending on how those elections are going to come out? But it is definitely a crisis for him, but also the organization itself, because it finds itself in a situation where there are elections that needs to take place in 2024. What does all of this do? Obviously, it works against them in a big way. Yeah.
And for those who don't know, of course, in South Africa, we don't have direct elections. The president of the party in power becomes the president of the country, and that person can be recalled if they lose popularity inside the country, inside the party, I mean. Pibo Kushle, just give us some idea of the inner workings of the ANC. Who are the actors vying for prominence of the party and the presidency? And I'll come to you, Chamano, on that as well.
Well, so I think that's why partly why we're here as well, because when Mr. Ramaphosa became president of the ANC, I was one of the people that actually voiced that we should be cautious as to how much action Mr. Ramaphosa may be able to do, because he was constrained. Why? Because his victory was basically a draw between factions in the ANC, between those factions that had been aligned to his predecessor and the factions which is called RET. They were talking about something called radical economic transformation. And then the factions aligned with Mr. Ramaphosa, the New Dawn. So he was always constrained by Secretary General and these and others. He was always constrained as to how much of reform he could do. So he failed to, as a result, he failed to have that much power to consolidate his power. And that is some of his supporters actually say that is exactly why he finds himself in this situation.
Tomorrow. Yeah, so obviously there are confirmed candidates for the, you know, position, obviously, of president. In this case, it will be Cyril Ramaphosa alongside Zweli Mkhize, the former, health minister. Then you have a position of deputy, president. As it stands now, we have David Mabuza, who is the current deputy president of the ANC and the country, but he did not make it to that list, which is just something else. But obviously, you have someone like Palma Shatile, who is the current treasurer general and also acting secretary general of the organization, vying for the position of vice president or deputy president. So it is not known what is going to happen by end of this election. Some are talking about the cat, the man who has always been referred to as the cat, David Mabuza. Are we going to see a nomination coming from the floor? Honestly, anything is possible. But I guess it's really just a game of wait and see.
And Tawana, we spoke about this before. That cat image has never left me since you brought it to my attention the first time. But can Cyril Ramaphosa Piwo actually survive this? Not just in the near term, but in the long term? Because we do have an election coming up in 2024, and that is the general election.
If I were to be clear with your viewers, I would say no, because there's a history. South Africa since 1994 has had five presidents. The first two, Nelson Mandela, and another one he basically stopped being president on his own volition, so he retired early. The other one was a caretaker president. The other two, Mbeki and Zuma, were removed before the end of their second terms. So the South African electorate is quite an itinerant and an impatient voter. Those of you amongst us who like democracy might think this is good for holding people accountable and so on and so forth. So if we're going by this history of South Africa, the presidents who had served the most of their time have been removed before they finished their terms. But here, he might be removed before he finishes his first term. Now, that's a big problem. If he has problems in his first term, we can't even speak of a second term, I think.
And Tumalo, what does all of this mean for the ANC, all these problems inside the party? What does it mean for the party's dominance in South African politics? This idea that the ANC come election time can be assured that they are going to walk away with the majority of votes at the end of the day, especially with 2024 on the horizon.
Definitely, it's a challenge for them. Obviously, it's coming at the time. If you were to go back to the previous election, already they had there has been a decline, and going into 2024, obviously against this background, so that becomes a huge call for concern for them. I guess we'll wait and see. But just going back to the question you are asking, in relation to what does this really mean? We are likely going to see a situation where the ANC probably get to a point of, a coalition. We don't know. But coalitions in South Africa, as we might have seen in the different, provinces, they are a bit of a problem. And let me tell you why I think they are a problem. Today, Party A and B, they get into a coalition. Tomorrow, they are no longer in good terms. What does it do then to, development?
Confidence, too,
development, because it is the things that needs to be done for the citizens. It is that project that simply just get stalled and nothing gets to, you know, to be done going forward. We've seen this even in Johannesburg, yeah.
But is this a feature of South African politics precisely because there isn't a real, not credible, but powerful alternative to the ANC when you have sort of, I would say, weak opposition in terms of the numbers? People go into coalitions based on grievances or problem they have with the ANC. We saw with COPE as well. Is that a problem when you don't have a strong, viable opposition to really take on a liberation movement with the stature of the ANC?
Well, it's been a problem for a long time. In South Africa, my statistics serve me right, no single opposition party has won more than 23%. So there's been a ceiling for a coalition. But the ANC in the last election got less than 60% for the first time. So the ANC is going down, the opposition parties are going up, but they still have ceilings. So if you're looking at a democratic standpoint, this is good to have coalitions because then there is an elasticity that is there for the politicians to say, well, I could be removed next month. This is new for the South African landscape. And so if you're looking at accountability, democracy, well, that might be good. But I would agree with my brother that there's a cantankerous nature of coalitions and a horse trading that might not lend itself well to a South Africa that needs to secure Mozambique, security problems, get rid of load shedding, big problems, get rid of 28% unemployment, $5,000, you know, per capita GDP for the first time in 13 years. So this is not good if to be playing with people's lives, but it's good for accountability.
Well, yeah, and the general theme from when you ask people on the street is the word disappointment and constant disappointment. It will be very interesting to watch. I'm going to ask you both. We have a few seconds. Yes or no answer. Does Cyril Ramaphosa survive this short term? Yes or no?
He is likely
South Africans
going to,
can never say something in one word.
He's likely going to, you know, survive it. You know, if one is just basing it on the outcomes of, you know, the meeting of the NEC over the weekend.
Yes. Yeah,
probably yes.
People push is short term, yes or no?
I took probability in school in statistics. No.
No. Okay. That's the shortest one-word answer we can get. Chamano Makadi, what a pleasure to have. Safe travels back to South Africa. Thank you so much. But great to see you here in Washington. Chamano Makadi is a broadcast lecturer at Tshwane University of Technology. And, of course, our dear friend Phiwakuhle Nyanda, Professor of African Studies at Howard University here in Washington. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining me here. We're going to take a short break here. And when Straight Talk Africa returns, my interview with Karine Kaneza Nantulia from Human Rights Watch about the state of human rights in African countries today. We'll have that interview for you after the break. We'll be right back. Straight Talk Africa, welcome back. December 10th is Human Rights Day, and today we're taking stock of the state of human rights in African countries. The African Commission on Human and People's Rights was established 35 years ago to protect and promote the rights of people across the African continent. Well, earlier I spoke to Human Rights Watch's Karine Kaneza Nantulia about the rights body and why she says its work is more important than ever.
This is a quasi-judicial mechanism, it's important to highlight that, that was established in 1987 to really promote and protect human rights and collective rights, as well as interpreting the one charter that we have, the African Charter on Human and People's Rights that was established in 1981. The commission itself was established in 1987. And when I wrote that the piece, it was really just after the commission has celebrated its 35 years of existence. And throughout its life, it has expanded the meaning and the implementation of human rights mechanisms, principles, standards on the continent. And it's more important than ever today because of two things mainly. One is the continuation of human rights and humanitarian crisis across the continent. Mm-hmm. When you look at the resurgence, for instance, of the M23 armed group in Eastern Congo, when you look at the continuation of terrorist attacks by armed Islamist groups in the Sahel, in Mozambique, when you look at the and also the emergence of new threats to human rights, hate speech, the violations that we see in the realm of digital rights, for instance, climate change and human rights violations where you have intercommunal violence. All this compendium of human rights violations make its work of promotion and protection and interpretation of the African Charter on Human and People's Rights very relevant and quite important. But let me just also add that it's also faced with a whole set of challenges. And the most important one being the political interference by AU member states and also African leaders' lack of action and lack of inclination to implement and follow suit on the African Commission's decisions and resolutions.
I think sometimes it's hard to really grasp how broad a concept human rights is. But what are the hallmarks of human rights abuses in a society?
I think it's what we see, what makes us anxious about the future of country X, Y, or Z. I think it's to see the amount of protest we've seen across the continent. It's also about the plight of refugees and migrants. There was a study that was done, I believe, 2 or 3 years ago, where they looked at the number of refugees, the type of countries some of the highest numbers of refugees come from. And the result was that 9 countries out of 10 are under authoritarian rule. So you do see a spike in crackdown against civil society organizations, the shrinking of civic space, the violations that we see around the freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, the number. And I think the other element that is important to keep in mind is we're talking about the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. When you look at the number of organizations, when it was established in 1987, there was just a dozen of civil society organizations that had observer status. Today, we have more than 500. That have observer status. 3 organizations have recently been denied observer status by the African Commission on the basis that the work that these organizations do around issues of sexual orientation, gender, and identity is not a right or a freedom that is protected within the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, which again, I think, highlights the danger of what we're seeing right now, which is this rise of intolerance, crackdown on dissent, on alternative views.
And it's global.
And it is global, absolutely.
Are there really worrying hotspots of countries on the continent right now which have really bad human rights records? And similarly, are there countries that are actively making progress and putting the issue of human rights protections at the top of their agenda?
I think right now what we see in different places on the continent is the a certain political will from the African Union to initiate regional processes to address peace and security crisis. So it's not from a human rights perspective, it's from a peace and security perspective. And our call has so far has been that they have to have human rights at the center, at the heart of these regional processes. And I can name at least two. One is the current regional initiative in Eastern Congo, where you have neighboring countries who, under the leadership of Kenya and the East African community, who have deployed a regional force to basically secure the eastern part of Congo. However, the pattern of abuse that we've seen in the region, in the Great Lakes, has gone unaddressed for a very long time, for decades. And as long as those grievances, because these violations are anchored in community grievances, as long as these are not addressed, the militarization of regional solution is not going to yield any result. So that is the first thing. The other thing is, we see, and that's, there's some bright spots in terms of justice and accountability, for instance, where you have, for instance, in July recently, the AU has decided to operationalize an AU trust fund for the victims of Hissène Habré's regime. And that's been, it's been years in waiting, and now, recently, the AU has decided to operationalize this trust fund. The other positive development is the recent trial by the Special Criminal Court in Central African Republic of three individuals who have been accused of crimes against humanity and war crimes. That's a positive development. However, we, for instance, have in South Sudan a hybrid court that's been established and is still not implemented, and that's a hybrid court that would have had, that supposed to have South Sudanese and African judges. It's a hybrid mechanism led by the African Union, and unfortunately we're still waiting to see it operationalized. I think the other important factor to keep in mind is that as much as we see few examples of positive development on justice, around justice and accountability, we also see a lack of action by African leaders on ongoing abuses that can lead to further abuses and atrocities. Ethiopia is a good example. We have the ongoing terrorist attacks in the Sahel. We have Sudan that's still embroiled in a political crisis. Up until now, African civil society organizations, including the African Commission on Human and People's Rights itself, have made various calls on the African Union to put pressure on these different leaders, but with no result.
Karine Kanezan-Antuya, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming in and speaking to us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
And that was Karine Kanezan-Antuya. She's the Deputy Director for Africa at Human Rights Watch, speaking to me earlier. And that is it for this edition of Straight Talk Africa. Of course, you can find more of our coverage on our website, voaafrica.com. And I do want to say thanks to all my guests. Thank you so much to all our affiliates airing the show across the African continent. And as always, thank you to you for joining us on television, radio, and for streaming with us online. I'll see you next time. Until then, goodbye.